Good afternoon, America. Welcome to Mark Levine's Inside Scoop, where we bring you all the news from Washington, D.C. The government does not want you to know. I'm your host, former congressional attorney Mark Levine. I've been out for a few days, and it's really good to be back here on the radio giving you the inside scoop. We have got a lot to talk about. We want to talk about the movie, Fahrenheit 9/11. I've seen it. Have you? I want to hear your thoughts on that. I want to talk about the turnover of power in Iraq, what some are calling the sleight of hand over in Iraq, since we're not really turning over much of anything. And finally, I want to talk about my anniversary on the radio. This is my anniversary, the first show after I've been on 1 year. And I want to give it a good chance to let you know who I am, how I got on the air. Very few of you are my original listeners from June 22nd, 2003. So I want to give you some idea of who is this guy that you somehow found on the air, and let you know who I am. Because actually, as I watched Michael Moore's movie Fahrenheit 9/11, I realized that much of what he's talking about, I had played some role, small or large, in. So I want to let you know kind of why I've devoted my career from a high-paying trial lawyer job to a very low-paying job trying to spread the truth about what is going on in Washington and what you can do to take out the worst president in American history. I want to first start, though, by going into just a few technical details because I know there's been some confusion. Many of you used to listen to my show on radiopower.org, that fine progressive website that streamed my show and Tom Hartman's and Tony Trupiano. And I suspect most all of you now are listening. Well, you have to be listening one of two ways. I only know one of two ways you can be listening to me. One is on my own website at radioinsidescoop.com, and I want to congratulate all of you who found my website, figured out how to download Windows Media Player, and are now listening to me by clicking Listen Live on my website. I don't know how you found me, by the blog or by my constant mention or Google or whatever. Welcome to RadioInsideScoop.com. A number of you, though, are also listening due to my hero and savior, Ben Birch. Ben Birch has been archiving my shows and that of about a dozen progressive radio hosts for some time now, ever since I began on RadioPower.org. And his site, www.WhiteRoseSociety.org, has done a terrific job of that. But now Ben has gone one further. And since Radio Power is in financial trouble, he's actually streaming my show as well via a peer-to-peer network, which is a bit complicated, but the heart of the issue is it's a little bit cheaper because as you play a show, you're actually streaming it to someone else, and so we kind of share the bandwidth here. I should say that I'm hopeful that RadioPower.org is not dead, that it can rise like a phoenix from the ashes. It died because it was entirely listener-sponsored, and donations were not enough to cover the cost of streaming. And it was that simple economic reason why RadioPower.org is no longer there. But if enough people recontribute, I hope that it can indeed re-arise. You can hear the stream lots of different ways, like I said, from my website, from WhiteRoseSociety.org by downloading the peer network. But because there's some ways that you can only hear via streamers like Radio Power, I hope we can revive that site too. Of course, some of you are listening on the radio. We always welcome you as well, but I'm talking right now to my internet streamers. I do want to talk about my history, if you will. Who is Mark Levine? I think many of you have heard me for a few weeks or months, but may not have any idea of my background. And as I was watching the movie Fahrenheit 9/11, I couldn't help but notice that just about everything Michael Moore mentioned, we had mentioned here on the Inside Scoop. I was very proud of that. About 95%. He did raise a few new things. And I really was proud of that because although I want to compliment Michael Moore on putting it all together in a nice package for everyone to understand, I am proud that most of what he had to talk about we had already brought here on the Inside Scoop. If you want to call in and ask questions and comment on Fahrenheit 9/11, comment on the sleight of handover in Iraq, comment on my 1 year in radio, your comments are always welcome. All you have to do is dial in 877-57-SCOOP, toll-free, 877-57-SCOOP, or you can send an email to comment at radioinsidescoop.com. I don't think I've ever taken a show, though, to explain who I am and how I got on radio. Some of that's on the website, but let me explain who is Mark Levine. I was born in Nashville, Tennessee. I went to Harvard College, got a degree in economics, magna cum laude. Then I spent a year on a Fulbright in Switzerland, and that was a very interesting year, learning how other cultures view America. I think it was that year really where I learned how other nations think about the United States of America. And one person in Switzerland, I think, put it best when he said, America's like a very large, kind of too large puppy dog. The dog means well, but when the dog wags his tail, he tends to knock over things like countries. So kind of exuberant. A lot of Europeans view America, at least 10 years ago, as an exuberant democracy, as a country that's trying really hard to do the right thing. And I appreciated that, but often does the wrong thing, perhaps because it's trying too hard, because it's trying so well to be loved. I don't know now what my Swiss friend would say about Bush's policies, where he doesn't care whether we're loved or not, and of course that's led to the largest anti-Americanism probably in world history. Anyway, I went from there to Yale Law School, and I actually, while I was at Yale, was very closely watching Clarence Thomas, Anita Hill, that controversy. Both of them went to Yale Law School, and a lot of people knew the people, and I learned at that time, by the way, that Clarence Thomas had run a pornography society at Yale. This is a story, by the way, that's got no print anywhere that I've seen. But there was a society at Yale called the First Amendment Society, and it was done at the time before Yale admitted women. Apparently, the women students might not have appreciated the porn. But Yale Law School, back in the 60s, only admitted men. And so Clarence Thomas and some five other students used to run a society called the First Amendment Society, emphasizing free speech, I guess. But really all they did was run porn movies in the basement. And a lot of professors knew this, but none of them told the press. They told their students, like me. And so I was not at all shocked when Clarence Thomas was accused by Anita Hill of watching porn and sexual harassment. And I didn't know whether her charges were true. I can tell you that all of her professors at Yale believed her story to be true. She was a conservative Republican, actually, from a very fundamentalist Oklahoma family and was known as being a very truthful person. So people tended to believe her. But I knew she was telling the truth when she mentioned how much Clarence Thomas liked pornography. And again, I don't mean to knock pornography. If you want to watch pornography, that is your right as an American citizen. I don't have a problem with that. But I do have a problem when Clarence Thomas, under oath, said that this was all a high-tech lynching and denied everything, including the porn part. And I knew that that was false. I knew that was false because so many people at Yale Law School who knew Clarence Thomas and Anita Hill knew that Clarence Thomas had not only liked pornography, but happened to run the pornography society at Yale. So I guess it was back then at Yale Law School when I started to realize that I could know a story, I could know a fact of quite a lot of importance, the fact that Clarence Thomas was lying on the stand, on the stand in the Senate, if you will, lying in the Senate confirmation hearing, doing it so under oath, about something not so much that's important. Again, I'm not really attacking pornography here, but when he called everything a high-tech lynching and tried to blame it on racism, I don't know quite how that would even work, given that Anita Hill was black. I knew he was lying, and I was actually shocked. I went down and tried to encourage those Yale Law School professors to come, go public, tell the press what they knew, but all of them were being very political and protecting their future careers, and none of them wanted to talk out. And I guess that was the time when I first began to realize, hey, I can know things that our government knows, that people in power know, that aren't being told to Americans. It's kind of interesting. So anyway, then I went to California for a number of years. I was a trial lawyer, making money, I admit it, paying off student loans, and basically going and helping my clients. Often they were big corporations. Not entirely. I helped individuals too. I can tell you that I helped those that wanted that not only wanted help, but I trusted. In fact, there were a couple times when I had clients that either lied to me or represented causes I did not support, and I asked my law firm not to that I didn't want to defend them. I said I really couldn't defend them if I didn't believe in their causes, and I didn't have to. So I fired some early clients. But in general, I was helping my clients whose cause I believed in, but wasn't really doing much politically. I was active in the California Democratic Party, in Southern California, basically just helping on election day. Didn't get too involved until impeachment came around. And I remember watching the impeachment hearings on TV and really being shocked at what we had to see. I mean, here it was, a president of the United States was being, they were attempting to throw him out of office for true lying under oath. Although I'm not convinced he ever lied under oath. If you want to call in and argue that with me, feel free, 877-57-SCOOP. But the point was is that I've always revered the United States Constitution, and I really could not see how this investigation into Bill Clinton's sex life made any sense, and certainly was not a high crime or misdemeanor, which of course is the standard for impeachment. And I remember being shocked as an investigation to Whitewater, the failed land deal turned up nothing, and all these other things the Republicans tried to find, Filegate, Travelgate, all of that turned up nothing. No, Bill Clinton did not murder Vince Foster. All these incredible allegations that they were making. And I began to read about Richard Scaife, the multi-millionaire, probably billionaire as far as I know, that spent hundreds of millions of dollars on the Arkansas Project trying to find some way to bring Bill Clinton down, not because of his sex life, but because he didn't like the liberal centrist principles that Bill Clinton had. And that got virtually no press. And then, of course, what happened is, again, if you want to discuss this, we can discuss this too, but Ken Starr was appointed by a team of three judges who were chosen by Jesse Helms, Senator Jesse Helms of North Carolina, the uber conservative. And they are the ones who allowed the Whitewater investigation, which was approved by Janet Reno, to morph into the investigation into Bill Clinton's personal life. After all, they couldn't find anything illegal he'd done, so the only thing they could find was that Bill Clinton would cheat on his wife, and that's what they found. But as I'm sitting there watching the House Judiciary Committee debate articles of impeachment, I'm really shocked. I had actually done some work in college on the previous impeachment, that of Andrew Johnson of Tennessee, who was the president after Lincoln, who was impeached. And I knew the standard for impeachment. I knew the constitutional standard as a constitutional lawyer. And I was really shocked, really, really surprised that they were breaking our Constitution, actually tearing up that document to get their political views in. I mean, if they don't like Clinton, sure, vote him out. Vote down his policy. Shut down the government like they did, which I don't approve of. But the Republican Congress had the legal right to do it. No one challenged their legal right. But as someone who's always revered the Constitution, someone who in law school, I was called the strict constructionist, in fact, because even though I was a liberal, I believe in the text of the Constitution. I believe in the text of law. I believe it should be followed. And I was really shocked that they were doing that. And so when Congressman Barney Frank came to California to give a speech in the middle of the impeachment time, I went up to him with a resume while he was in the buffet line, which I just taken a risk going up to a politician when he's, you know, feeding his plate in the buffet line, and gave him my resume and offered my services to him, said if he ever needed a lawyer. He didn't at that time, but he remembered me a couple years later when I came to Capitol Hill. But that's how I got my first start in politics, and that, I guess, predates the movie Fahrenheit 9/11. Going on, the next real thing that I watched, of course, was the election of 2000. And that I watched very closely. In fact, I even offered myself as an election lawyer to Al Gore. Can you imagine if he'd hired me as an election lawyer? You know, I have this fantasy that I'm sitting there holding the ballot box in Florida saying, you know, the whole world's watching, the whole world's watching, don't stop the vote count. And, you know, and we could all, me and all the blue-haired ladies of Florida could be holding on to those boxes while the police close in. And I say, no, don't let Scalia stop the vote count. Oh, well, that's my fantasy. Then, of course, I wake up screaming. But, you know, I actually did serve as an election attorney in California and protecting people's right to vote. I remember very clearly going in there, and it's amazing. You know, most of these people that are poll workers, they mean well. They're paid $5 a day, and they come from all facets of society, and some of them know exactly what they're doing. In fact, most of them, I would say, are patriotic Americans who know exactly what they're doing. But there's a good minority who don't, who are new, who haven't had training, because like I said, California paid them $5 a day, and are retired, and thought they knew the law. And they don't. I'll give you a little example. In California, we had a law, a very good law in California, that says that if you're voting in the wrong precinct, and precinct boundaries change all the time, if you're voting in the wrong precinct, you can still cast a ballot for those same candidates that you would have been able to vote for if you were in your proper precinct. I'll give you an example. If you're in California, and even if you're in Southern California, Los Angeles, and you try to vote in San Francisco, of course you can't vote for the local mayor, of course you can't vote for the local congressman, but you could still vote for the senator of California, the governor of California, statewide offices. You could still vote for president of the United States to contribute to California's electoral count. And that makes sense to me. There's no reason why you shouldn't be able to vote for the same people. And there's a provisional ballot. It's a bit complicated. But that is the law in California. When I was there, I was amazed at, again, all the ways the system broke down. Because someone would come in and they'd say, I want to vote. And they'd say, oh, this isn't your precinct. And the person would say, well, where is my precinct? And they'd say, well, we're not sure, but this isn't yours. And it could be an older person. It could be someone saying, well, you know, forget it, then I won't vote. And they'd say, you know, okay, suit yourself. And I'd have to step in as an elections attorney for the Democratic Party and say, hey, you do have a right to vote. Don't turn that person away. You can vote provisionally for these other things. And so I protected several dozen people, dozens of people, right to vote. And that was a really empowering experience to do that. And so knowing election law, as I did, watching the election in Florida in 2000, watching it all pan out, was really quite of interest to me. And I remember watching into election night, much as Michael Moore did in his movie, Fahrenheit 9/11. And so I'm watching on TV with a good friend of mine, and I had always been a political junkie. I had all the state's electoral votes organized. Who I thought the state was going to go to. I predicted Florida for Gore based on the latest exit polls, and actually it was pretty good in my predictions. And in fact, when Gore won Florida, I called my friends and family, let them know that Gore had won the presidency. I knew, I could tell at that time that Florida made the difference. But as the night got longer, and of course, George Bush, who was planning a victory party, turned ashen when he heard about Florida and ran home and then tried to convince the press to undo Florida. And then, of course, when George Bush's first cousin, John Ellis at Fox News, announced Florida for Bush, and all the other networks quickly followed, I was busy watching the Florida election returns. And to this day, I'm really glad that Michael Moore brought this out, I think it's shocking that I would say more than 90% of Americans do not know that the person that called the election for Bush was his own first cousin working at Fox News. A conflict of interest, anyone? But John Ellis, Bush's first cousin, called it for him. All the other networks followed suit. And I remember watching the election returns, precinct by precinct. The Internet's an amazing thing. And I remember thinking, you know, Broward County hasn't come in yet. There are a lot of Jews there. Jews were tending to vote for Gore. There was the county that Key West, Florida was in, where a lot of gay people are. And I know that gay people tend to vote for the Democratic Party because Republicans have been so harsh on gay people. And I remember noticing in Palm Beach County that there was a tremendous number of people that voted for Pat Buchanan, which I thought was very surprising. And so I'm frantically calling everyone I know in the Gore campaign in Florida, you know, using my cell phone, saying, don't concede, don't concede. And I don't know whether Gore got my calls. I kind of doubt it, but I'm proud to say he didn't concede that evening. And it was really reliving the experience for me watching Michael Moore, at least the first part of Michael Moore's movie, 9/11. So I hope you're appreciating this sort of monologue into who I am and how I got into politics. If you want to call in and ask questions or participate, feel free to do so. It's 877-57-SCOOP, 877-57-SCOOP, and we'll be right back after these messages.
was used during the recent California grocery store workers' strike and allowed management to secure wage and benefit concessions and union contracts. The hotels broke off the talks last week. The Hotel Employees and Restaurant Employees Union says it'll take the employer's final offer to its members on July 1st.
With terrorist attacks on the rise, many people fleeing the country, and insurance costs going through the roof for those who stay, the government of Saudi Arabia is desperately looking for ways to entice foreign oil workers into staying on the job. Their latest proposal, allowing foreigners to carry firearms for personal protection, may seem like a prudent move, but the cultural implications are less positive. Saudi citizens can't even carry concealed weapons without a permit, and the idea of more armed Westerners roaming the country has its own implications for the growing insurgency.
More bad news for MCI workers. The telecommunications giant announced another round of layoffs on Friday. More than 2,000 workers will be disconnected at call centers in Colorado, Kansas, South Carolina, and Iowa. The latest layoffs bring to 16,000 the number of jobless MCI workers since the end of last year. Many employees were informed that they would lose their job only a day before in a listen-only conference call lasting less than 1 minute.
Lie about the company you run, get $2 million? That's the fortunate outcome for Philip Watts, the former chairman of Royal Dutch Shell. He resigned in March after being caught inflating the company's proven oil reserves by as much as one quarter. When the scandal broke, the company took a beating and Watts stepped down along with two other executives. Now Royal Dutch Shells paid Watts a whopping $2 million in severance and appreciation for his 35 years of service to the company. Watts is also eligible for a $150,000 a year pension, the status of which remains undetermined. Here's today's Dow Bob Report. Less than half the workers in the private sector now receive health benefits from their employers, according to analysis of figures from the Bureau of Labor Statistics by the Labor Research Association. That's the lowest coverage rate in more than 40 years. By 2006, more than 53 million people may be uninsured, an increase of about 10 million from the present, and expect premiums to rise again next year, somewhere between 12 and 15% on average.
You've been listening to WINS, the Workers' Independent News Service. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. I'm your host, Mark Levine, telling you a little bit about myself. I don't usually get a chance to go in extended lengths talking about who I am and how I got into radio, but as I was watching the movie Fahrenheit 9/11, which just coincided with my one-year anniversary on the air, a lot of things in that movie made me think back to why I got involved in radio, how I got involved in politics, why I care enough to throw away a high-paying profession of being a trial lawyer and a constitutional lawyer and actually coming to be a radio host. Why I'm, you know, Michael Moore's making money doing this. I'm not, but basically how it is that I came to want to tell you all the news from Washington. The government does not want you to know. Anyway, I remember election night, and after Gore conceded and then thankfully took back his concession, and I remember, as I said, frankly calling the campaign, and all that morning, in fact, I called CNN to notify them about the Buchanan spike, the fact that he'd gotten so many more votes in Palm Beach County than anywhere else. And again, I don't know whether I alerted CNN to that fact or not, but I do know that it wasn't on the air until 30 minutes after I called them. In any case, I was very interested in the election legal proceedings. Obviously, I'm a lawyer. I care a lot about the Constitution. I had researched impeachment. I researched election law. And it was fascinating to me. My poor clients were on hold for a while because I told them, you know, I'd really work hard for them after the election. And then, of course, the selection process went on for another month or so. But I did follow the proceedings very closely. I couldn't help it. It was a fascinating moment in American history. And I watched virtually every trial in every Florida courtroom, everything from the butterfly ballot controversy to the controversy over the Republicans filling in the ovals when they weren't clear for Bush. Did you know they did this? This is something that's gotten very little attention still to this day. The Republicans in one county where the Republicans were running the elections process, if ever they saw the slightest mark for Bush, it didn't go through their machine-readable machines. I mean, you know, they had like little ovals in this county where you fill in with a pencil, and the machine's supposed to read it. You know, like they read SATs or other things where you fill in the ovals. And if people didn't fill in the oval all the way, then it wasn't counted as a ballot for Bush. So what they did is they looked, and whenever anyone had marked Bush, they filled in the ovals all the way, stuck them through the machines again, so that Bush would get those votes counted. Now, actually, I wouldn't have a problem with that if that were the same standard statewide. After all, the Florida law, in fact, is that when you have a voter's intent, that intent should be counted. But keep that in mind when all the Republicans discarded all the Democratic ballots where they did exactly the same thing. They didn't fill in the oval all the way. Or they made the mistake of voting for Gore and Lieberman. Those votes weren't counted because they said, oh, that's a double count. You can't vote for Gore and Lieberman. Option's choice was Gore-Lieberman rather than Bush-Cheney. But Democrats were not afforded the same courtesy that the Republican voters were afforded. And to this day, that story has gotten very little play. And I followed the stories of the blacks being disenfranchised, particularly in Jacksonville, where roadblocks were set up. And more importantly, the tens of thousands of voters that were removed from Florida voting laws because they were accused of being felons when they weren't felons at all, including more than 50,000 African-American voters when 93% or so of those voters voted for Gore. So I'm watching all of this very carefully. I'm thinking of what legal arguments I would make. I even volunteered myself again to be on Gore's legal staff, and I wish he'd hired me. I would have very much liked to have played a role. He didn't, and Al Gore, you should have hired me. Anyway, I'm watching it very closely. I'm even doing things because, okay, I'm a little obsessed. My friends say I'm obsessed about the election, but I was. And I was even sending briefs to people I knew who had worked in the Gore campaign, some fairly high-up people, passing them on to the Gore team, hoping they'd read them and use them. I have no idea what they did. And, of course, I remember that day when – that very happy day when the Florida Supreme Court said – we are going to count all the votes in Florida. That's what Florida law provides for. And Judge Terry Lewis of Leon County, Tallahassee, Florida, was actually taking in all the returns from all the different counties. He was going to investigate them, make sure they were all done under a single standard to be fair. And the Republicans were doing what they could to junk up his fax machine. I'll never forget, I think it was a Friday night before, while Judge Terry Lewis was making his ruling following the Florida Supreme Court ruling. And again, I got into the details. I got into the arcana of all the elections. And he's saying, all right, when you send in returns, send them by fax too. And I remember thinking to myself, don't do it. Don't say your fax machine on national TV, because I thought they'd try to junk up his fax machine and he should have written it down. Poor Judge Terry Lewis actually said his fax number. And all throughout the night and the next day, there were Republicans and others, really people who are against democracy in America, there's no other way to put it, sending notes like elect Bush and sore loser men and all this stuff, purposely trying to disrupt the Florida elections process. And let me say that if you are listening to this broadcast and you did that, or you hear someone or you know someone has done that, I think you should go to jail. I think you should go to jail for disrupting American democracy. And, of course, we all know what eventually happened. The Supreme Court had its ruling, which I watched very carefully, and its ruling came down to basically say that we'd love to count all the votes, and in fact democracy is so important that we should count all the votes, but we're setting a deadline 2 hours from now and there's not enough time to do it in the deadline that we're setting arbitrarily, therefore Bush wins. And we could talk in detail. I'm always happy to talk in detail about the Supreme Court decision in Bush v. Gore, because it left me in a state of shock. As a constitutional lawyer and someone who's very interested in politics, I guess I didn't believe, until it happened, I didn't believe our Supreme Court was capable of a coup d'etat, was capable of treason. And these are very strong words, very strong words, and yet I have to call it what it was. The opinion in Bush v. Gore, I think, will go down in history as the single worst opinion in American history. I know some of you will say, well, what about Dred Scott, which said that people had a right to own slaves? The thing about the Dred Scott opinion, as horrible as it was, and it led to certainly more lives lost in the Civil War, is that Dred Scott actually had a certain logical sense. Slaves were treated as property in America, and that's, of course, horrible. But it was the law at the time. Therefore, Dred Scott, while being a horrible opinion, an opinion that helped codify a truly awful, inhumane, racist law, at least was legal. It codified, it's like apartheid. It was a legal, racist, horrible regime. What Bush v. Gore did, though, was not follow the law. The opinion itself is internally inconsistent. It doesn't even make sense on its own terms. It did not follow the law in any way, shape, or form. As I said, it actually violated a whole series of precedents. And even worse, it did not make sense on its own terms. I'll just give you one quick example of this. Basically, the court held that Florida's system of electing the President of the United States, the same system Florida had used for more than 100 years, saying that what matters is what the voter intended. If you can determine who the voter wanted to vote for, that vote should be counted, which makes sense. It's a system. That system was so messed up, was so incomprehensible, was so unfair as to be completely unconstitutional. They held in the first part of the opinion. And then they held in the second part of the opinion that this completely messed up, unconstitutional system meant that Bush wins under that same system. Now, if you got a system that's messed up, if you're playing a game and somebody knocks over the board, all right, you can either say, you know, we'll play again, have another vote count. You could say, we won't count this game. All right. You can say, for example, in Florida's case, we won't count Florida electoral votes, as happened, by the way, during the Civil War. There's plenty of precedent for that. We'll count the other votes, in which case Gore wins. You could say, well, we'll call it a tie. A tie would certainly be fair, given Florida's election result, and we'll split the electoral votes. Hey, we'll even give one extra to Bush, 13 to Bush and 12 to Gore, in which case Gore still would have won. So you can vote again. You can throw out the results. You can tie the results. You could blame whoever knocked over the board. You can say Florida election officials. They're the ones who messed it up. In fact, it's even in the Supreme Court decision that if Catherine Harris had done her job like she was supposed to do and actually put definitive standards in Florida law, then we would have been able to choose the President of the United States. She failed in her job. She was chairman of the Bush campaign. Therefore, Bush has to suffer. All of those are reasonable conclusions. But it's completely illogical to say that the system is completely screwed up. Therefore, we won't go by the system and count the votes, but we'll take this interim result, which has no basis in law or the Constitution, and by that interim result done by an unfair system that we've just called unfair, Bush wins. I hope you followed that. If you didn't follow that, give me a call, 877-57-SCOOP. It's just one of the many, many inconsistencies and horrible illogic of the Supreme Court's decision in Bush v. Gore. Which I should note that I don't know anyone. I have never met anyone who will defend that decision, a lawyer who will defend that decision on its legal merit. There are plenty of conservative lawyers that say, hey, I'm glad Bush won, or I'm glad the Supreme Court stepped in. But I don't know a single one that will go through the logic of the opinion with me and actually thinks it's logical. Even Judge McConnell of Utah, a judge so conservative that he was filibustered by the Democrats, agrees that the Bush v. Gore was an opinion that did not make sense as a matter of law. Anyway, so, and I'm making this a long story, but hey, it's my anniversary. I'm allowed to do that. And I hope you're enjoying these stories. Again, if you want to call in, number is 877-57-SCOOP, 877-57-SCOOP, or send a comment to comment at radioinsidescoop.com. So after reading this opinion and being in shock and reading it again, look, I knew this Supreme Court wanted Bush to be president, and I thought they'd find some obscure law that I hadn't found in my research to somehow install Bush as president, maybe. I hope they wouldn't, but I thought they might do that. I never thought they would just break the law and the Constitution and just make stuff up. 2 + 2 = 5, therefore Bush wins. I didn't think they'd do that. I still have enough faith in them that they wouldn't do that. It's interesting that the four dissenters basically called their colleagues lawless. You had Justice Stevens saying that we cannot believe that judges are impartial guardians of the rule of law anymore. And Justice Ginsburg perhaps made it most eloquent when, instead of the standard phrase, "I respectfully dissent," which is what you do when you disagree with a Supreme Court decision and you're in the minority, she just wrote, "I dissent." It was clear the decision had no respect. So what did I do? I just got mad and I decided to write a layman's guide to Bush v. Gore, a explanation, a Q&A, question and answer, explaining to someone who's not a lawyer that, you know what, the emperor has no clothes. I know you think that Bush has been improperly installed by the Supreme Court, but you don't know how. And maybe you think that, oh, it's the Supreme Court. They ruled according to law. Well, I wanted to show that actually the opinion by its own terms doesn't make sense. So I sent this email off to maybe 20 people, urged them to pass it on, concluded with a good activist bent. I knew that when you've got a corrupt Supreme Court, which clearly is what we had, at least five of them, and a corrupt presidency, that the only way to save our country was to go to the third branch, the branch of Congress. And I knew that the best way, I thought, to fight the opinion was to fight back to the Supreme Court where it hurt the courts. The Senate, of course, has to approve the president's judges. And I knew that Democrats had enough members to filibuster. All you need was 41 people in the Senate, senators, to filibuster to prevent a Bush judges from going into effect. So here was my plan. It was that the Democrats should filibuster all Bush judges, every one of them, until such time as we had a president elected by the American people instead of by the courts. If the courts were going to choose the president in violation of the Constitution, in violation of everything from the preamble, "We the People," all the way down to the 12th Amendment, which talks about how you choose president and vice president of the United States, if the court was going to violate that, then we shouldn't allow the court to have any judges. That was how the people could fight back. And I'm still convinced if the Senate had hung together and not approved any Bush judges or said that Al Gore should decide some of those judges until we can have a true recount, I think that would have been the best way, you know, without violence, to stop this coup d'etat in our government. Anyway, I sent it out. I was angry. I felt better after I wrote it. I wrote it in about an hour, sent it to about 20 people, and urged people to pass it on. And that day I got back maybe 50 emails, and I thought, oh, well, people are passing on. That's really cool. And the next day I got back several hundred emails. And the next day I got back several thousand emails. I clearly had hit a chord. In fact, Michael Moore loved the email. In fact, he's the guy that titled it "A Layman's Guide to Bush v. Gore." I had titled it "The Gore Exception to the Rule of Law." And he passed it out to his membership. And this thing went round and round and round the globe. I got emails from all 50 states, from several countries, I think some 20-something countries nationwide. Ended up getting about 12,000 emails overall. And that's just the people that emailed me back. I wasn't even working in Congress at this time. I was just a lawyer in California. And the emails I got back were very interesting. Al Gore's lawyers wrote me back, thought I did a tremendous job. Bush's lawyers wrote me back, did not challenge the logic of what I had to say, but asked me whether I was really a lawyer. Where did I go to law school? Wanted to know my credentials. And I told them I went to Yale Law School, gave them my class year, and they never wrote me back. But what was interesting also, members of Congress wrote me to congratulate me, people from all walks of life. My favorite email was from Sandra Day O'Connor's former clerk, who wrote me that he agreed with me that his boss, his former boss, was a hypocrite. Now, you know, obviously justices tend to hire people of like mind. And to have Sandra Day O'Connor's clerk write me that clearly his boss is smart, clearly she knew what she was doing. You know, this isn't a case of people accidentally making a mistake or construing an ambiguous law one way or the other. She intentionally broke the law to make Bush president, which I guess isn't surprising from a woman who on election day, and again, this wasn't in Michael Moore's film, which I wish could have been 4 hours to include all these details that I'm filling in. But you may remember on election day, as soon as she heard Gore won Florida, she said, "That's terrible," walked out of the room in disgust, and left her husband to explain to the other members in the room where people were watching the election that she wanted to retire and could only retire while a Republican was president. And I think at this point she's scared to retire unless Bush is actually elected by the people rather than chosen by the judges. So this thing went around, and I got about a dozen radio shows. I'd never been on radio before. About a dozen radio shows called me from across the country, Los Angeles, Chicago, Delaware, many places in Florida, in fact, called me and said, who am I? And they'd gotten this email, been passed around, and invited me on their show. And that's when I started to get the radio bug. When I come back after this break, I want to talk a little bit more about my history and how it relates to Michael Moore's movie. You may remember that part early in the film where you have the Congressional Black Caucus looking for a senator to sign that objection to the Florida electors. Well, actually, I played a major role in that, and I'm happy to share it with you right after this break. If you want to call in, by the way, ask me any questions about my experience or how it relates to Michael Moore's movie, Fahrenheit 9/11, feel free to call in 877-57-SCOOP, 877-57-SCOOP, 877-577-2667, or you can send an email to comment at radioinsidescoop.com. And by the way, I'm curious if any of you know, many know that Fahrenheit 9/11 is based on Ray Bradbury's book, Fahrenheit 451. Can somebody call in and let me know what is the significance of Fahrenheit 451? Why 451? Do you know? We'll talk about it at the end of the hour. Coming back right after this.
Time for another Gooberhead Award, issued periodically to people in the news who have their tongues going 100 miles per hour but forgot to put their brains in gear. Today's Goober goes to an organization that marches under the majestic banner of Move America Forward. MAF would have you believe that it's a nonpartisan mass movement of patriots supporting our troops and the commander-in-chief in the war on terrorism. But the majesty of this outfit shrinks to minuscule when you peek behind MAF's red, white, and blue curtain and see that it's nothing but three pathetic right-wingers with a Mr. Microphone. Move America Forward is a front group set up only last month by the Republican PR firm of Russo, Marsh, and Rogers, which pocketed some $2.5 million in payments from Republican politicians in the last election cycle. Far from being patriots, these hired flacks set up MAF to engage in a decidedly unpatriotic act of selectively canceling the First Amendment. What has their knickers in a knot is that Michael Moore's dynamite new movie, Fahrenheit 911, is being shown in theaters all across America. Apparently, Russo, Marsh, and Rogers don't believe in the principles of free speech and open debate. At least not if these principles allow open criticism of their beloved King George W. So these gooberheads launched MAF to trash Moore and try to prevent theaters from presenting his movie. On their website, they published the addresses of major theater chains, asking rabid Bush supporters to deluge the chains with demands to shut out Moore. Tell the industry executives that we don't want this misleading and grotesque movie being shown in our local cinema, shrieked the PR hacks. This is Jim Hightower saying, whether or not you like Moore, no true American can like this goofy, totally un-American stab at censorship. The best way to show up these goobers is to go see the movie and judge it for yourself. That's the American way.
38%.
46%.
42%.
I cut my payments in half.
How much can you cut your monthly student loan payments by refinancing with College Loan Corporation? To find out, just call 1-800-2-COLLEGE. You'll quickly be connected to an expert loan consultant who will answer your questions and tell you how you can cut your monthly payment by up to 50% by refinancing your federal student loans at rates as low as 2.63%. 1-800-2-COLLEGE. It's the smartest call you can make.
You know, out here in West Texas, it gets really hot, and it's a tough, dry heat.
Glenn Austell of Lubbock, Texas, talks about Gold Bond medicated powder.
When I'm working outside, my skin gets itchy and irritated. I guess you call it a heat rash or something like that. But Gold Bond relieves the itch and irritation and gives me a cool, refreshing sensation. I'm telling you, once you've tried Gold Bond, you can't live without it.
Gold Bond medicated powder cools and soothes heat rash and irritated skin. Use it directed.
I mean, who wouldn't want to feel cool and refreshed?
We'll be right back. Welcome back to Mark Levine's Inside Scoop. I'm your host, Mark Levine. It is my one-year anniversary on the air, and I'm given quite a detailed history, I think, of how I got on the air, how I got involved in politics as a congressional attorney. I hope you're enjoying it. I think that, maybe once a year, but we'll give the story again. But partly I'm giving it because it so much tracks the movie Fahrenheit 9/11. My producer's saying, Mark, get on with it. But you know what? There's so much in the early parts, the election parts, that you know, lasted all of 2 minutes, but were very important to me at the time, still are important to me now, and I can give you some of the facts behind the movie. Michael Moore obviously focused mostly on the war in Iraq, and that's fine and good, but he didn't have 4 or 5 hours to go into all the details, and so I wanted to talk about some of the things that I knew that was going on before and around and surrounding the events that you saw in Michael Moore's movie. And if you want to call in and comment on the movie or what I've been talking about, feel free to do so. It's 877-57-SCOOP, 877-57-SCOOP, or send an email to comment@radioinsidescoop.com. Let's go to the lines now. Caller, you're on the air with Mark Levine. What's your first name and where are you from?
This is Ed from New York. You asked where Fahrenheit, the Ray Bradbury Fahrenheit came from.
Right.
And that's the burning point of paper.
Very good. And why is Fahrenheit 451, the burning point of paper, significant?
Because, and I really don't remember the story of Fahrenheit 451. I just, I got to fess up and tell you that I heard it on another talk show.
Okay, fair enough. Well, I'll tell you why it's important, Ed. And I haven't read it either. It's one of those books that's on my shelf that I've been planning to read for 20 years or so. But in my understanding is that in the book, the people in control, the dictators or whatever in this new world, don't want people reading books, because in books people find information that can take down a dictatorship. And so the reason why it's so important is because if you find a book, they burn it. And therefore, you have to know the temperature in which books burn. So
thank you so much for telling me that. I heard the number of the burning point of paper on two or three other shows, but I didn't know the significance of the story.
Right.
I really appreciate your
telling me. Yeah, what it really means is control of information. And so that's why Michael Moore took it and made, of course, Fahrenheit 9/11, based on 9/11, because it's all about control of information. It's all about burning information that a powerful dictatorial government doesn't want its citizens to know about.
It's something like the old Big Brother book.
Exactly. I mean, there's not, you know, between, you know, 1984 and Brave New World, Fahrenheit 451, they're all sort of the same idea of a futuristic society where you have a government controlling information. And what we've learned here is that it's not just, you know, dictatorships, totalitarian countries that control information. Even in our own country, which unfortunately is becoming less democratic than I would like, the control of information is very important, and that was the point of Michael Moore's using Fahrenheit 451. Thanks very much for your call, Ed. I appreciate it. I want to go back and just go on, and we're going to continue this discussion more on Wednesday. We'll talk more about Michael Moore's film and some of the facts that I know behind the film and take more of your calls then. But Tuesday we'll have Election Tuesday where we'll take another hapless Republican, someone who actually, and this always amazes me, actually believes Bush's lies. I always like to have them on the air. It's a good reality check to check in with our fellow Americans who actually believe Bush's lies and actually have the amazing fortitude to actually come on my program and defend George Bush, which I think takes, I don't know, I think it takes a very strong stomach. That'll be this Tuesday. And then coming up Thursday, by the way, is a really terrific show. Now that I'm not in a radio power, I can extend my show. I think I'll probably do a 2-hour show. And the question is a very interesting one. It's, when is it proper to out gay politicians? And my guest will be my former boss, Congressman Barney Frank, and some gay newspapers who are talking about when there's a number of closeted gay politicians in Congress too, by the way, I should say, in both the House and the Senate, and we're going to talk about when their names should be disclosed to the people. I hope you'll listen in on Thursday. But anyway, continuing with my path and with the election of 2000, following that election and the response I got from my email. By the way, if you want to read that original email, just go to my website, www.radioinsidescoop.com. Click on the Who We Are And I tell a little bit about this story. You can click and read the original Q&A and find out my explanation, at least, of the Bush v. Gore decision that got so much attention. Got George Stephanopoulos to write me and praise it and ask if he could mention it on the air, and got me involved in radio. Another thing it got me was Democrats, specifically a group that still exists called Democrats.com. You can find them on the web. The Internet was still relatively new at that time, and Democrats.com was trying to aid Democrats. And they wanted to write a brief for the Congressional Black Caucus that wanted to challenge the Florida electors on the floor of Congress. And having read my brief and liking my legal arguments, they hired me. And the Congressional Black Caucus, via Democrats.com, hired me to write the brief challenging the Florida electors. So I was very proud to see that that had a moment in Michael Moore's film, to see Maxine Waters and Jesse Jackson Jr. And but it wasn't just blacks, I should say. There were also whites and Asians in there as well. They were all Democrats, of course. And they were carrying around my brief challenging the Florida electors, and I think you can get to that as well if you want to read. Now, that's more legalistic, but if you want to read the brief challenging the Florida electors, you can get that on my website as well at www.radioinsidescoop.com. And they were talking about, you might remember in Michael Moore's movie, and in fact I have a question on my email about this, why didn't any Democratic senators sign the minority vote objection as shown in Fahrenheit 9/11? And that is a great question. And Michael Moore doesn't answer it. I don't think he knows the answer. But with all due respect to Michael Moore, I do know the answer. I was there. I wrote the brief. And I tried very hard to lobby Democratic senators to sign on. And I want to explain why they didn't. Because I don't think this has been reported anywhere either. Hey, that's part of what the Inside Scoop is about, giving you the facts behind the news. Here's what the deal is, and you've got to understand the law a little bit on this, but I hope you'll find this interesting. And if anything's unclear or you want to ask me a question about it, as always, the phones are open, 877-57-SCOOP, 877-57-SCOOP, or send an email to comment at radioinsidescoop.com. What happened was this. The way the law works is if you have an electoral slate coming in from a state, it can be challenged right up to the date when Congress counts electoral vote. That's why the Supreme Court opinion, which set an arbitrary deadline of December 12, 2000, was just dead wrong. And anyone who knows the law knows it was wrong. There was no deadline on December 12, 2000. And I can explain what that date was. If you really want to know, call in and I'll explain it. But there was no deadline to count the votes. In fact, in the Nixon-Kennedy election, Hawaii's slate came in, and as late as January 4th, 1961, they changed Hawaii's vote from Nixon to Kennedy as more accurate information came in. So there's clearly precedent for changing that. But if Congress doesn't want an electoral slate, they have to have a member of the House and a member of the Senate challenge it. And this is under a law. 3 U.S.C. Section 5, if you want to look it up. It's on a law passed after the disputed Hayes-Tilden election of 1888. And basically it says that if a member of the House and a member of the Senate vote, sign an objection, like the objection I drafted for the Congressional Black Caucus, if they sign an objection, then the two houses of Congress vote. And the members of the House vote and members of the Senate vote on whether to accept that disputed electors. What they understood way back in 1888 when they passed this law is that the decision of who should be president of the United States is inherently a political decision. It's not a judicial decision. And in fact, they specifically did not want the Supreme Court getting involved. And they made clear the Supreme Court had no jurisdiction to decide this. Another reason why Bush v. Gore is an unlawful, unconstitutional opinion. So they said the court shouldn't decide this. If it's going to be an election where we're not sure who won, then this should go to the members of Congress should decide. So if there's an objection by a member of the House and a member of the Senate, then the House should vote on who they want to be president, and the Senate should vote on who they want to be president. And there's no question that the Republican House would have voted for George Bush. The Senate, as you may recall at that time, was exactly 50 Democrats and 50 Republicans. But the new Congress is sworn in early January, and the President of the United States isn't sworn in until January 20th. So in that intermediate two-week, three-week period, you may remember, Al Gore was still Vice President of the United States. As Vice President of the United States, he was President of the Senate, and he could vote for any tie vote. So if all 50 Democrats voted for Gore and all 50 Republicans voted for Bush, Al Gore could have broken that tie, and the Senate would have voted for Al Gore. So everyone knew that if the House, if a member of the House signed the objection and a member of the Senate signed the objection, the best case scenario for the Democrats, the likely scenario, was that the House would vote for Bush and the Senate would vote for Gore. Deadlock. Well, there's an answer. And the answer is in that 1888 law. The people who wrote that law figured there might be such a deadlock. It wasn't obvious the House and the Senate were going to vote for the same candidate. So they said, if the House and the Senate vote for different candidates, then it goes back to the chief executive of the state from which the returns came. In other words, if a Democratic senator had signed that objection in Michael Moore's movie, They're Looking for the Democratic Senator, if they'd signed that objection and the House had voted for Bush, the Republican House had voted for Bush, the divided Senate 50-50 with Al Gore casting a deciding vote had voted for Gore, it would go back to the chief executive of Florida who would cast the deciding vote, and that chief executive, of course, was Jeb Bush. Governor Jeb Bush, brother of George W. Bush. Jeb Bush would have cast the deciding vote for his brother and installed his brother as president. Now, I knew that when I wrote the brief. I'd studied the law. I knew that when I wrote the brief. I told the Congressional Black Caucus that. But all of us supported the brief because all of us wanted to show that what was the shenanigans that were really going on here. All of us wanted to force it so that Jeb Bush would have to cast the deciding vote for his brother. Maybe then the American people would realize that this president was illegitimate. But the Democrats knew that at the end of the day, even my objections were not going to change who became president. Bush would still become president. And so my brief became a bargaining chip, in fact, in the Senate. And I happen to have heard through the grapevine, and I do believe this to be true, that the Democrats at this time were 50-50 in the Senate with the Republicans. There had not been a 50-50 Senate in 100 years or so. And generally, the majority party in the Senate controls the committees. You have, since the Republicans control both the House and the Senate, there are more Republicans than Democrats on every committee in Congress. And that's very important because all laws have to go through committees before they hit the floor of the House or the Senate. Well, Democrats, the Republicans really, really didn't want a Democratic senator to sign on to my brief, the Congressional Black Caucus brief, because it would look bad to have George Bush chosen by his brother. So they gave the Democrats something unprecedented. It was horse trading. They traded away a Democratic objection. In return, the Democrats and Republicans got 50-50 seating on the committees. Quite crucial. All the committees were evenly divided, even though Dick Cheney was going to be vice president and could cast a deciding vote, and Republicans could force majority Republicans on these committees, in exchange for giving up my brief, my lovely brief, in exchange for a Democratic senator not signing on to the objections, the committees were split 50-50, thus giving the Democrats more power. Of course, the Democrats could not have known that just a few months later, Jim Jeffords, independent, was going to switch parties and the whole deal wouldn't have been necessary. But I did want to explain why a Democratic senator didn't sign on to the brief I so lovingly crafted for the Congressional Black Caucus, the brief that they were waving in Fahrenheit 9/11. It was subject to good old horse trading. And as much as I was upset at the time, I guess in hindsight, I don't blame them. Getting 50-50 on committees was very important. We were going to lose anyway as soon as Jeb Bush cast his vote for his brother. And so that's why the vote was cast away. And that's, again, part of why I'm here on radio, to give you the inside scoop, the scoop behind the scoop, letting you know what was really happening in those days. Tomorrow we're going to have Election Tuesday, as we always do. We're going to see if we can figure out why Republicans still defend this president. It's an amazing thing. And then Wednesday we're going to come back to Fahrenheit 9/11. I promise to go faster during that time. It won't be so much about me, but we'll move on to what's going on in Iraq, the war, the movie, how it affected you. I think one of the most moving things in that movie actually brought tears to my eye was the mother of the person that died, how Michael Moore effectively, I think, was patriotic, supported the troops, and yet at the same time made a devastating critique of Bush's war in Iraq. So I hope you'll tune in tomorrow, Wednesday, and then, of course, that great show Thursday when we ask the very difficult question, when is it proper for a progressive to out a closeted gay politician? Thank you for listening in on RadioInsideScoop.com. Please tell all your friends, by the way. Some of them may have been listening on RadioPower.org. Tell them, since you folks can hear my show, whether you're hearing on RadioInsideScoop.com or you're hearing on Ben Birch's WhiteRoseSociety.org, however you're hearing the show, please tell your friends and family, because many may have tuned in the old way. Let them know how they can still hear the Inside Scoop. This is Mark Levine, thanking you for listening and signing off.